It is Monday, August the 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the Iran nuclear deal, the U.S. and GCC concerns.
The problem that the both leaders have is they're afraid that this will open up to a rapprochement between the West and Iran.
Also ahead, a vaccine to prevent Ebola, plus President Obama has a plan to limit carbon emissions. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is on a multi-nation trip, which took him to the Middle East over the weekend. After meeting with officials in Cairo, his first stop in the region, Mr. Kerry flew on to Qatar for meetings today with the Gulf Arab Forum ministers, whose nations are part of the Gulf Cooperation Council. High on their agenda likely will be the recent Iran nuclear deal, with which the GCC has taken some issue. VOA's Victor Beatty speaks via Skype with Stephen Zunis, an international relations scholar specializing in the Middle East and a professor at the University of San Francisco. Victor asked Zunis if he would be a tough sell for Secretary Kerry to persuade the GCC to embrace this nuclear deal.
The problem with the Gulf leaders is less the details of the deal itself, which is, according to most observers, pretty reasonable. And indeed, it reduces the threat to those countries in terms of any potential nuclear confrontation. The problem that the Gulf leaders have is they are afraid that this will open up to a rapprochement between the West and Iran, and therefore perhaps compromise their influence. As a result, Secretary of State Kerry's job is basically to reassure them, if you will, that there are still some serious problems between the United States and Iran, that just as the United States and Soviet Union could sign the SALT agreement back when there was confrontation in Vietnam and Central America and Africa, that is perfectly reasonable for the United States to seek arms control while still maintaining this rivalry for geopolitical influence.
Stephen, as you know, the President Obama hosted a meeting of Gulf Cooperation heads of state at Camp David, the presidential retreat near Washington, some weeks ago. Some of them didn't show up, including the prominent one, Saudi King Salman. Was that a sign of their displeasure about the Iran deal?
There are various interpretations as to what might have motivated that. There were quite a few other things to talk about, not just the Iran nuclear deal, but issues around Yemen, around Israel, around ISIS, around other concerns. But there's definitely somewhat frosty relations. There is great concern about sort of money coming from the Gulf Arab states that are not from the government necessarily, but from elements that are supporting radical Islamists in Syria and elsewhere. And there are also some concerns regarding the unwillingness of the Obama administration to challenge Israel more directly in terms of their creeping annexation of the West Bank, making a two-state solution more and more elusive. There are a whole number of concerns that the our Arab Gulf leaders have that go beyond simply the Iran nuclear talks.
Mr. Kerry arrived in Doha from Cairo, where, despite concerns about human rights, the U.S. Sunday resumed formal security talks with Egypt. Is that important?
Egypt is still considered a very important country by the United States. It's by far the largest country in the Arab world. It is the center in terms of media, higher education, and other influences. At the same time, the increasing repression, which in many ways has surpassed even the darkest days of the Mubarak era, has led to concerns by many Egyptians and many human rights activists around the world that this increasing security cooperation between the United States and Egypt is essentially given the military-backed government there a freer hand. But, of course, that doesn't bother the Gulf monarchies because they have their own poor human rights record, and they are concerned about comparably bad records in neighboring countries.
As Stephen Zunis, he is a professor at the University of San Francisco and an international relations scholar. specializing in the Middle East. He was speaking via Skype with my colleague Victor Beatty. Well, as you can tell, the U.S. officials went out of their way to praise Egypt for its handling of the economy during Sunday's strategic dialogue in Cairo. With some social media response, International Edition's Michael Lippin is here. Michael?
Hi, Steve. The U.S. Embassy in Cairo's Twitter account, which is at U.S. Embassy Cairo, sent out a tweet on Sunday quoting Secretary Kerry, and this is what he said. We welcome the steps President Sisi has taken to improve economic conditions, hashtag strategic dialogue. The U.S. Embassy Cairo's Twitter account also tweeted a quote from another U.S. official taking part in the economic session of those talks. It said U.S. Ambassador David Thorne told Egyptian officials that their country has extraordinary potential. The U.S. Embassy in Cairo also tweeted this quote from Thorne, "Congratulations to Egypt on its remarkable economic progress this year." If you want to follow Thorne on Twitter, you can find him at AMB_Thorne. He is the senior advisor to Secretary Kerry and the former U.S. ambassador to Italy, but he's only got about 350 followers on Twitter.
And Michael, has there been much talk on Twitter about Mr. Kerry and what he'll be doing in Qatar today?
Well, not a whole lot, although the Russian embassy in the neighboring United Arab Emirates said that Kerry will join a three-way meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov and the Saudi Foreign Minister. Associated Press diplomatic writer Matt Lee found that to be particularly interesting. Lee's handle is at AP Diplo Writer, and he reported that the agenda for that three-way meeting of U.S., Russian, and Saudi foreign ministers will be largely about Syria. Now, two of those three nations, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, oppose Syria's president and support the moderate rebels trying to oust him, while Russia is a firm backer of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But none of those three nations are a fan of the Islamic State militants in Syria, so perhaps they'll discuss ways of working together against that group. Steve?
Yeah, I guess we'll see, Michael. Many thanks. That's VOA's International Editions, Michael Lippin. If you'd like to follow Michael, he's on Twitter, and his handle is very simple, at Michael_Lippin. You can also follow us, International Edition, on Twitter. We're at VOA_IE. And by the way, Michael Lippin will be back later in the program with some big news out of Washington about climate change. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Nigerian army said late Sunday it rescued nearly 180 people held by the militant group Boko Haram, most of them women and children, at camps in the country's northeastern Borno state. Army spokesman reportedly said a Boko Haram commander also was captured and several militant camps clear by around the town of Bama, about 70 kilometers north of the state capital, Maiduguri. Earlier on Sunday, the Nigerian Air Force backed some ground forces as they attacked Boko Haram fighters around the village of Bita on the northern edge of the Sambisa forest. Nigerian authorities say they killed a large number of militants southeast of Maiduguri. Meantime, the French press agency says 13 people were killed, nearly 30 wounded early Sunday by suspected Boko Haram fighters in Malare village, about 20 kilometers south of Maiduguri. Also in the news, a Burundian general and top advisor to the newly elected president, Pierre Nkurunziza, was shot and killed. Happened Sunday in a drive-by shooting in the capital, Bujumbura. General Adolphe Nshimirana's assassination comes just over a week after Mr. Nkurunziza was declared winner in his controversial bid for a third term in office, widely condemned by the international community. Nshimirana, who served as Army Chief of Staff and Intelligence Chief, was seen as playing a key role in the crackdown on violent street protests against the president's re-election bid. He is also believed to have been a central figure in putting down an attempted coup in May. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the shooting. Media reports did say the attackers used automatic weapons and grenades in the attack, and Reuters is reporting they wore military uniforms. A UN peacekeeper was killed and several wounded by several unknown gunmen in Bangui, that's the capital of the Central African Republic, as they attempted to serve an arrest warrant for a former leader of the mainly Muslim Salika Rebel Alliance, which seized power back in 2013, you remember, before being forced to step down last year. The country has been engulfed there in sectarian violence since then. Two Malian soldiers were killed. At least four others were wounded when their convoy was ambushed Saturday in central Mali between the towns of Nampala and Diabali, about 400 kilometers north of the capital, Bamako. Country's desert north has been home to a number of armed groups, including Al-Qaeda-linked militants. They scattered during a French intervention back in 2013, and insecurity has shifted southward in recent months. A second American hunter is now suspected of killing a lion in Zimbabwe without a permit. Jan Kazimir Seski of Pennsylvania is accused of killing a lion with a bow and arrow back in April. Prince Mumpazariu, the Zimbabwe Secretary of the Ministry of Climate, Environment and Water.
The report that we received relates to an incident which happened in April. And that's why you find we have banned every activity so that we can investigate and establish the truth of the matter. But as of now, our law enforcement officers are looking into the matter so that we can really understand what transpired and if whatever happened in April was illegally done.
Seski was named as a client of Niala Safaris, who had been arrested. This latest development follows last week's revelation that a Minnesota dentist, Walter Palmer, killed a rare black mane lion known as Cecil in the Hwanga National Forest, in a story that's received international attention, including an outrage on social media. Well, at last, there is a way to end the suffering from the Ebola epidemic that has ravaged West Africa for more than a year. Researchers say the vaccine that they've come up with is so effective, there may never be a major outbreak of Ebola again. VOA's Carol Pearson has our report.
The Ebola outbreak that swept through West Africa claimed more than 11,000 lives. Children, mothers, fathers, doctors, and nurses. No one was safe. The epidemic was so horrifying that countries around the world finally rallied in sending help, building treatment units, training medical staff, and helping governments work toward ending the epidemic. Rival pharmaceutical companies work together to produce a vaccine, and at last there is one, produced in record time and said to be highly effective. Dr. Junge Arne Rutingen is one of the study co-authors at the Norwegian Institute of Public Health.
Based on the number of individuals and cases we see, there is 100% protection in those vaccinated.
The vaccine combines a protein of the strain of Ebola that ravaged West Africa and another unrelated virus. The result is a weakened virus that cannot cause disease, but generates an immune response. Health workers and others at high risk were the first to get vaccinated, along with thousands of volunteers.
What we did was to follow the epidemic in a way. We identified contacts of new cases and also contacts of their contacts, and therefore had identified a cluster or a ring of high-risk individuals. And those were the ones who were enrolled in the study.
No placebo was used because the virus is so deadly and the researchers wanted to save as many lives as possible. Producing the vaccine and conducting the study was an international effort involving Doctors Without Borders and the World Health Organization in Guinea. The Norwegian Institute of Public Health designed the study, and Merck produced the vaccine. There is still no licensed vaccine against Ebola. The licensing process is time-consuming. But the plan is to keep the study going until there are no more cases of Ebola in West Africa. Researchers estimate the epidemic will finally be over in a few months. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Here in Washington, President Obama set to unveil new regulations today aimed at cutting carbon pollution that comes from the nation's power plants. The goal is for the plants to reduce their carbon emissions by 32% below 2005 levels, and to do that by the year 2030. My colleague Michael Lippin asked VOA correspondent Michael Bowman about Mr. Obama's intentions.
Michael, the Obama administration is coming out with new rules, new regulations, by which U.S. power plants, specifically coal-powered plants, would reduce their emissions by just over 30% from the levels that were recorded in 2005. And they would have until 2030 to do so. And this is something that the administration has been discussing for quite some time, but President Obama is coming out with this formally later Monday.
Any specific reason for the timing of this announcement coming out on Monday?
I don't know that there's a specific reason for it. What I can tell you is that there are many groups in the Obama coalition, you might say, who have had their backs scratched from those who wanted health care reform to those who wanted gay rights to move to the front of the line, many different elements. But the environmentalists have always felt like sort of the forgotten stepchild. And now in the last 18 months of the Obama administration, it looks like they're going to be getting their due.
They wanted to have their time to be in the spotlight. So what has to happen for these targets for reduced emissions to actually be implemented?
Well, first of all, it would be the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, that would be at the forefront of this. However, the EPA is not going around to each and every power plant and directing them as to what they have to do. Rather, they are going state by state and telling states, this is what you must achieve by the year 2030. We're not going to tell you how to get there. We're not going to tell you line by line what you must do, but this is how you must comply by the year 2030. And they're leaving it up to individual states to go about crafting a plan under the assumption that individual states will do so in the way that is least economically harmful and most beneficial.
How much power do states have to push back on these regulations? Do they have no say whatsoever? Do they actually have some scope to protest if they want to?
Well, it wouldn't just be the states. It would be their representatives in Congress. Now, this is not something where the administration has to ask Congress for permission. The Obama administration has control over the EPA, and the EPA has a great deal of say as to what happens with power plants. However, if the Republican-led Congress were able to do so, it could pass a law overruling it, or a more likely route for them and for individual states that object to this is to challenge it in court, to challenge it in federal court, to say that this is an overreach of the federal government into individual states. They will make it a question of states' rights versus the rights of the federal government.
And that means potentially the Supreme Court getting involved at some point.
Potentially, if it were to go that high, yes.
VOA's Michael Bowman speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
New research from Australia's University of Adelaide is providing evidence that plants, which don't have a nervous system like animals, transmit animal-like signals when they're under stress. The findings show that plants respond to stress in their environment with a combination of chemical and electrical signals that are similar to those emitted by animals under stress. Senior author Matthew Gillingham, a professor at the Australian University, says that it's been long known that an animal neurotransmitter, GABA, is also produced by plants when they encounter stress such as drought, salinity, viruses, acidic soils, or extreme temperatures. The researchers made their findings when they noticed that a plant's neuroreceptors connected with its corresponding GABA neurotransmitters in a way that's similar in animals. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Bobby Christina Brown, the recently deceased daughter of the late entertainer Whitney Houston, will nest next to her mother's grave at the gravesite in New Jersey. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Ray McDonald of VOA Music about the mysterious circumstances surrounding the 22-year-old Brown's death and what will become of her mother's estate.
The world was shocked by the death of Bobby Christina Brown recently. She was found face down in a bathtub, very similar to her mother, Whitney Houston. Ray, this is eerie. This is really, really creepy. And January 31st is when they found Bobby Christina unresponsive.
Right.
And so now she's dead, and now it's like all the lawyers are trying to decide what to do with the estate, because she was the sole heir to her mother's fortune.
That's exactly right. And beyond that, prosecutors want to try and figure out who, if anyone, was responsible for the death of Bobby Christina Brown, even though an initial autopsy showed no underlying cause for her death and no injuries.
Now, there was some question about a guy who was her half-brother or an adopted brother and then became her husband.
Nick Gordon.
Nick Gordon. Yeah, what's going on there?
Well, Nick's role in all of this is very nebulous, and I really can't say specifically that he did anything. I mean, he and Bobby Christina were together in her Atlanta area home. He found her face down in the bathtub on January 31st. As I say, the initial autopsy didn't reveal anything, although prosecutors are treating it as a homicide investigation. There will be more tests to come. Bobby Christina herself her funeral will be a private affair, and then she will be flown to New Jersey to be buried alongside her mother, Whitney Houston. This has yet to play out, and I'm not exactly sure how it's going to play out.
And there's a lot of money at stake here. I mean, Whitney Houston, Bobby Christina was the sole heir of Whitney Houston's entire estate. Mm-hmm. Millions upon millions of dollars. Now, her grandmother, Sissy Houston, is still alive, as is her aunt. But according to Whitney Houston's will, everything went to Bobby Christina in a trust, I believe, right?
Everything went to Bobby Christina in a trust. And this is going to be a very tangled case. Legal experts are at odds over exactly how it will come out. But it's going to take a long time and a lot of money.
Now, where's her father, Bobby Brown, in all this? What role is he playing?
Well, right now, Bobby is just saying, you know, he's devastated by the death of his daughter. He tried to be at her side every moment that he could during her 6 months in hospital. I think Bobby is just so emotionally devastated right now that he really has yet to get his bearings.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. If you have any questions or comments about this, you can hit us up at VOA_music. That's our Twitter handle. You can also send a tweet to VOA_IE. Listen for Ray to count down the top 20 and the top 5 hits of the week. You can find that at www.voanews.com.
Wish we had more time and more of that. That's Bobby Christina's mom, Whitney Houston. Also very missed. British singer Cilla Black, a product of the Beatles-era Liverpool, who became a national treasure for more than 50 years in music and television, has died. She was 72. Here's Cilla Black singing Anyone Who Had a Heart. This is back in 1964.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. dreamed could look at me and know I dream of you.
Yeah, very, very nice. Spanish police said Sunday that the singer had died Saturday at her home in Estepona, that is in southern Spain. Former Beatle Paul McCartney said news of Black's death came as a shock. Black was born Priscilla White in Liverpool in northwest England in 1943, and as a teenager she sang part-time and worked in a cloakroom at the Cavern Club, where her musical talent was spotted by rising local stars, the Beatles.
Every time you go away, I always say, this time it's goodbye, dear. Loving you the way I do.
Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. And for our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now some more of Cilla Black.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the U.S. State Department reviews efforts by foreign governments to combat human trafficking. The use of children as soldiers by nations and armed groups is an egregious form of this crime and is a special concern. While the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers is a global phenomenon, the 2015 Human Trafficking Report indicates, as it has in the past, that the practice is most critical in Asia and Africa. Children are often abducted, or at times sold, to be used as combatants. In addition to participating in combat-related activities, children are sometimes forced to engage in hazardous activities, such as laying mines, and are frequently killed or wounded. Some have been forced to commit atrocities, and most suffer psychological scarring. Both female and male child soldiers are often sexually abused, or at high risk of contracting sexually transmitted diseases. In 2008, our nation enacted a law that requires the Secretary of State to identify countries that have governmental armed forces or government-supported armed groups that recruit and use child soldiers. The law requires that the Secretary of State compile and publish a list of those countries in the annual trafficking report. These countries then face legal restrictions on access to certain types of U.S. military assistance and training. Eight countries were listed this year: Syria, Burma, Sudan, Somalia, South Sudan, Nigeria, Yemen, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Listed last year, the transitional government of the Central African Republic and Rwanda are making progress to reduce the recruitment and use of child soldiers and weren't included on the sanctions and restrictions list. The sale and trafficking of children and their entrapment in any form must be eradicated, and their unlawful recruitment for labor or sexual exploitation in conflict areas must be stopped. All nations must work together with international organizations and non-governmental organizations to take urgent action to disarm, demobilize, and reintegrate unlawful child soldiers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage.
at www.voanews.com/editorials.